anthropologist and state anthropologist in Pennsylvania. He's done research among various Indian groups in the East, Cherokee, various groups of the Iroquois like the Seneca, and also in the Southwest with the Hopi, the Paiute, and so on.
What's that? Here.
Yeah, is this turned on? Not turned on?
It's a light.
Oh, wait a minute, I'm sorry. I thought I was talking this way. How's that? Oh, you're right on the seat. May I repeat? I was just going through the formalities about John Witthoff. Educated here at the University of Pennsylvania in anthropology, and then for many years, state archaeologist and state anthropologist in Pennsylvania. He's done research with various Indian groups, ethnological research among various Indian groups here in the East, the Seneca, the Cherokee, various other Iroquois tribes, also in the Southwest with the Hopi and the Paiute. And he's also done archaeological work here in the Eastern States and in Arizona and Wyoming. I think most recently is a search for archaeological sites in Wyoming. That's the formal side. He's written a great many papers, and I was amused to see when I got his bibliography that there were no list of what he had published, but a dozen articles which he's now writing. And I think that's very characteristic of John. He's got 12 or 11 articles in process. I hope, John, I don't wait too long. Now, on the less formal side, I should make some comment about John Witthoff. I don't quite know how to characterize him as an anthropologist and archaeologist, except to explain what he is not. That may be an odd way to go about it. But let me give you an example. Years ago, when I was working in the Arctic, a Frenchman named Gontran de Ponsin wrote a book called Kabluna on the Eskimos. I thought it was an excellent book, a very interesting, exciting book, very well written. It had very little to do with the Eskimos. It was a marvelous account of a Frenchman in the Arctic. John is just exactly the opposite. He disappears himself in his accounts of either the ancient Indians or the living Indians. He treats them like anybody else, as they are, just people. And I think you write about the Pennsylvania Dutch or the Boston Irish in exactly the same way. And I think this is one of the best comments I can make on his research, both the archaeological and anthropological, that they fit in this world in which we all live. I've just been talking to him about the problems of American Indians today, in which he's very well versed and very much a part of what's happening in the present time. Great pleasure to introduce John Witthoff.
The Indians of the original 13 colonies is quite a chunk to try to fight off. Partly because of this business of the very strange character of the royal grants from the kings of England to various individuals, companies, and institutions that set up the colonization of British North America. These royal grants were often rather careless in defining their boundaries, and in most cases they defined no western boundary for all intents and purposes these tracts of land might be considered as running to the Pacific. And of course these royal grants did not recognize the French claims to New France, to the Mississippi Valley, or to Louisiana. But that was soon taken care of on the field of battle. As for the other problems about these royal grants, the northern boundaries of Massachusetts in Maine and beyond were never defined and led to a minor border war, which Maine has always regretted, because it acquired property that wasn't worth owning. It led to, at the time of the American Moosh Revolution, the Pan-Amite Wars in northern Pennsylvania, in which the Connecticut settlers did battle with the Pennsylvania settlers. It led to two other border wars on the fringes of New York, one between the citizens of Delaware County, New York, and their neighbors on the Pennsylvania side of the disputed boundary, and another little border war between the people of western Connecticut and the people of southeastern New York. So that these boundary disputes, usually taken care of by courts before the revolution, and often settled in the most ungentlemanly way after the American Revolution, with this kind of sloppiness in our real estate boundaries and definitions, you can imagine what the problems were when it came to the American Indians of the 13 original colonies. Today, it is hard for us to realize how restricted the British colonies within the present United States were prior to the American Revolution. Almost all settlement was east of the Allegheny. Some of it was within the mountains, and a few people had penetrated beyond, but very few, and they were there illegally. At the same time, big populations had built up in mountain valleys that today have very small populations east of the Allegheny, as for example in central Pennsylvania. Big rural populations that after the American Revolution were to spill over like great waves onto a western frontier. In the period of British domination of the colonies, the British, for very practical reasons, attempted to maintain a rigid boundary between the territories of the Indian nations and those of the colonies. And for example, the boundaries that they drew at the Treaty of Fort Stanwyck in 1768 placed much more than half of present Pennsylvania within the Indian territories, and considerably more than a half of the state of New York. At the same time, the British, in their attempt to maintain these boundaries, were primarily concerned with preventing disorder, not with real estate titles or with justice. And the Americans, who were much less concerned about preventing disorder, were often in conflict with the Crown over the validity of these boundaries. And with the end of British domination, this western frontier was to become an uncontrollable wave as compared to the relative stability that the British had been able to impose upon it by placing the control of Indian affairs under the control of only two officials who were primarily answerable only to the Crown. Many Indian communities found themselves swallowed up east of this boundary of settlement of the 13 original colonies, but most of them, by the time of the American Revolution, had been so thoroughly absorbed into the life, economic, social, political, and so on, of the white countryside, that it is difficult to see them as Indian nations, but rather as people of Indian culture living as a part of the rural scene of this eastern world. West of this boundary were what we think of as numerous and populous tribes, all of whom insisted upon their separate sovereignty. Now, their separate sovereignty has turned out to have been a myth at that time, as well as in ours. and I will have to say something about that. When William Penn established his government in Pennsylvania, we, with our strange ideas about dates and important events, think of this as a great landmark and as the beginning of the present regime in this part of the world. But by 1688, an awful lot of the events of history had already long before transpired along this Atlantic coast. And the world which Penn knew, both the world of the Pennsylvania white man and the world of the Indians, was almost as different from the world of 1500 along that coast as the present world is different from the time of Penn. In this scene of history and prehistory, there are amazing bodies of mythology which in colonial times and later became almost a part of the national creed. And it is one or two chunks of this that I want to comment upon. Our earliest history of the Atlantic coast along the reach of the American colonies will never be written, because there are no documents, and there probably were very few men ever involved in this history that could read and write. The great events that would shape the future of the American colonies and of the American Indian were taking place unknown and unknowable to the minds of men along this eastern coast at a date considerably before that of any significant records. For example, with the first penetration of Delaware Bay by European sailing ships, these European sailors found themselves an almost ideal port and point of supply in the vicinity of present Rehoboth, Delaware. And here, from the times of the first unrecorded exploration, sailing ships put into this well-known port area to take on water and wood and barter for food with the inhabitants, who occupied, apparently, a fairly considerable town nearby. The world that was known to the Dutch sailors of the middle period of this stage of exploration had changed drastically from that of the early stage. The land known through its coast in this Dutch period was a land that was apparently vastly underpopulated. It was a land of wilderness and scattered Indian communities. It was a land which was still devastated by epidemic diseases, and it was a land which the Dutch observers saw as devastated by intertribal warfare. And so, from the very beginning of the period of written records, not the beginning of the first exploration, we get a picture of an underused continent inhabited by rather small American Indian populations who were involved in intense intertribal warfare, which was devastating to the peace of this whole countryside. We note, for example, that this port area around Rehoboth, the favorite resort of European sailors in the early and middle colonial periods, and still the point at which ocean-going ships must pick up their pilots to get to the port of Philadelphia, that the area was named by the Dutch after Lewis Creek, which at that time was called the Horned Hill. Now, this word got corrupted in the geography of the early English settlers and became the Horkill, but it did not lose its meaning. And this term offended the delicate ear of William Penn, and he changed the name of the creek to Lewis Creek, after the name of one of the settlers. The Horkill, that is the stream where we go a-whoring of the sailors, was adjacent to the Nanticoke sites, which we know in some slight degree from the archaeology, and was the site of an Indian town whose history was unsuspected until recent times. And the history of this town is in a capsule, the history of the North American Indian in this period. This region, from the time of the first Dutch contact, the first European contact, at what date I do not know, but possibly as late as 1498 or a bit earlier, had been devastated by a number of contagious and epidemic diseases carried to the Indians from contact with white settlers, with white sailors and explorers. These epidemic diseases quickly passed into regions far beyond the indirect knowledge of any of the explorers or people involved in the white contact. And the effects of these epidemics can only be seen in the ground, in the archaeological record of Indian towns of precisely the right date. And this precisely the right date for central New York is about 1500 to 1550 AD. This precisely the right date for the Delmarva Peninsula is about 1500 AD and so on. During this stage, Indian populations were decimated in a manner that we cannot comprehend or understand. I should not say decimated, because that means having one person out of 10 killed. It would be much more realistic to consider that possibly one person out of 20 or one person out of 50 survived these early bundles of epidemic. Now, these Indians did not know what had happened to them, and their theories of disease were as inadequate as those of Europeans at the same date. And the Indian explanation, at least for some of these catastrophes, was to blame it on their enemies. And unfortunately, these people didn't know who their enemies were. And the people ought to be blamed for these sudden waves of death would be the people of other Indian tribes against whom they had some sort of grudge, and whom they would blame for causing these catastrophes by sorcery. So that we get the intensification, if not the actual beginning, of organized Indian warfare in North America as a consequence of biological accidents from the period of first contact. And the Indian towns of the eastern United States, such as the town at Lewis, Delaware, were towns that had been vastly affected by this process. The largest portions of their populations had been killed off by disease and in war, and the death rates for men from both causes were far higher than they were for women. And so the frustrated and lonely sailors who touched into this beautiful port at Rehoboth and Lewis found themselves faced with a huge population of lonely and frustrated American Indian widows and old maids. And they were gloriously received. Now it was the intent of these desperate women to steal husbands off of these ships. And some of them succeeded. And this was a considerable hazard to navigation in that age. It was enough of a hazard to navigation so that ship captains and officers would go to very considerable lengths to recapture men who had jumped ships to go live with the Indians, whether from their own ships or from others. And if they did not put them together to death instantly, they certainly killed them very quickly under the brutal discipline, under the lash on shipboard. So what happened to these men who jumped ship? We have very little says anything about them in the Dutch or in early English records, but we have enough to make a guess. They came up to Philadelphia and went up the Schuylkill River to the unexplored interior where they and their newly found women were safe from any chance of ever being found by Europeans again. Now, we read in the books that the word Schuylkill means the hidden river of Dutch. This is not true. And the early English documents do not call it the hidden river, but they call it the Hyders River, the river of the refugees. This was where runaways went. This was the land of refuge for the men who jumped ship in the Delaware Bay. Now we can go through one piece after another of our standard historical rubbish and pick it apart in the same way that I've attempted to do with the term war kill and school kill, and see a very different kind of reality back in these little scraps than what we think of in conventional history. Doubtless, the Indians learned a great deal from these runaway sailors, who in a few years would have acquired adequate control of the local language, and whose ideas and descriptions of the vicious working man's world of Europe must have seemed like a picture of hell itself to the American Indians, coming from men who had fled to some kind of a comparative paradise and peaceful social world. And so it is not surprising that in our early historic records we find the Indians not quite as naive as we thought they should be towards these strange comers from across the sea, because they already knew something about them. And in fact, they had samples of these men among them from the earlier period. So one of the first settlers at Germantown, a Luther minister, writing back to Germany in 1688, says in his letter, "We know very little about the Indians of the province and scarcely ever see anything of them. They avoid us at almost any length and do not wish to have anything to do with us. And those that are still living here in the province are turning their land and their other property into portable wealth as rapidly as they can, so that they may leave and go to the western lands to get away from any contact with the white settlements." In Quebec, in the early 1600s, we note in the records that some of the Indians of southern Quebec blamed the scourges of the epidemics upon the French, not upon the sorcery of their neighbors. And they said, "This is French sorcery, and is the stuff the priests do with their mumbo jumbo and their chalices and so on." And this idea the Indians talked of a great deal, and the French officials were afraid because the Indians were talking about a total civil uprising to end this scourge of French witchcraft and sorcery, which they said was destroying the people. But the Indians did not have courage enough to, because the magic that they saw and its consequences were too deadly for the populations. In the South, in Louisiana, the first of the French historians tells us that when the French first came, this land seemed populous, and the Indians seemed a hazard. But they said in every year they had been dwindling away until now there are very few of them left. And they had been constantly scourged by diseases, and thus God, by his kindness, has swept away the heathen and made place for the French success in the colony of Louisiana. It is only from occasional scraps in this early literature that we can get some picture of what had happened in the early conflict period, and it is only from the precise archaeology of sites of exactly the right date that we can get any additional information, any figures on death rates, any figures on what was happening to different parts of the population, and today a little bit of evidence from the bones themselves about the actual pathologies involved in this early period. So the significant things that have happened that shaped the world for the Indian and the white man took place in the very beginning of the period of exploration, and everything that came later followed from what had happened to Indian populations. And this destruction of Indian populations, except in the central heartland of New Spain, was not done by military violence or by any deliberate method, but was an accidental consequence of biology involved in this contact, which was going on without any actual understanding by white man or Indian of what was actually happening. The Jesuit de Casa, a contemporary of Columbus, described the armed Spanish destruction of the peoples of the Caribbean in a manner that historians are unwilling to buy, and which most people will not believe, and which has led to a favorite phrase among historians, which they call the black myth of Spanish cruelty. The more we know of the history of this age, and the more we know of the populations of the Caribbean area and of the details of early Spanish conquest, the more we are sure that Casa was exactly and precisely right, probably even in his population figures, and that the historians have been too soft-minded and too soft-hearted to see one of the grand experiments in human depopulation that was carried on in the New World. Thus, most of the area east of the mountains was largely emptied of Indian population in the period before the first attempts at establishing colonies were made. And the major factor in this emptying of the Atlantic seaboard was infectious disease, and the second factor was the blood revenge growing into intertribal warfare that was a consequence of stupid and magical thinking on the part of the people as to where disease came from. feud, revenge, and warfare based ultimately upon sorcery belief. However, this chaotic world of colonial times was also reshaping the behavior and the skills of the Indian peoples who were involved in it. And with the growing intensification of revenge and feud and tribal warfare, a new kind of man was coming into existence, whom we may refer to as the classic Indian warrior. This is a man who grew up in a world of great desperation and early death, an individual of great daring and fortitude and hardiness, a man who was probably the finest potential professional soldier that the world has ever produced. Because regardless of the magical bases for much of his behavior, in every case, his violence centered completely about the defense of family and community against outsiders who were thought of as perhaps less than human. And it was this kind of man, unleashed in the border wars with the whites, and unleashed and only partially controlled by the French and by the British in the French-Indian War, that became a specter of terror and of mythology with which all of our old literature is tainted. The man, his capabilities, his desperation, and his vast skill are real. The picture of him as a depraved kind of mankind, always poised to strike the innocent settler, is our contribution to the myth. And it was this specter of raising the hornet's nests, of desperate men beyond the frontier, that caused the British to show so much concern about maintaining a rigid boundary between the Indian and the white nations. And it was this boundary that was to fall away and collapse after the close of the American Revolution. And it is this boundary that has been falling away and collapsing ever since, whether in military sense or in legalistic sense. Today, we are beginning to be able to reconstruct, largely through archaeology, this history of the true frontier, both the frontier exploration along the coast and within, and the frontier edge of later white settlement. At the same time, some people doing very precise and refined work in historical research are combining modern medical knowledge of pathology with scraps drawn together from many little corners of the old documents to give us a better picture in terms of the actual biology of what was happening. There were many strange events that took place on this frontier. The great tularemia epidemic of about 1760, which struck the peoples of the Western Great Lakes and the spruce forest to the north of them, practically wiping out and exterminating the beaver of this region, and at the same time killing at least 9 out of 10 individuals in this whole region, where the beaver was the intermediate host for the bacteria of tularemia, which had been brought to New France with domestic rabbits from Europe, passed to wild rodents, and then became epidemic among the beaver of North America. In the same way, plague came to the Iroquois shortly before 1640, probably carried not as they claimed in the magic and in the chalices of Father Jacques, but probably carried in the lice and fleas of the clothing of this holy man. The smallpox epidemics ran and ran until we can't understand why they ever did. Shortly after James had discovered vaccination using cowpox, he received one of the most wonderful tributes any man has ever received from an American Indian community. The Iroquois Nation of Canada sent him a wampum belt accompanied by a letter in which they thanked him for the knowledge of vaccination and said that he must be one of the greatest benefactors that mankind had ever known. Since the conquest of North America took place through methods, we might call them weapons, that nobody knew were in operation and that nobody understood in their operation. And it was this open land, scared of people by now, whereas before it had been teeming with people, that immediately attracted the envy and greed of Europeans as a vast resource which should be extracted from the people who owned it. This extraction of real estate from the Aborigines of North America has been going on and still goes on at an alarming rate since the beginning of contact. And those of us who have gotten involved in some of the legalistic and other battles about this had gotten a very considerable education in the process. Today, many of the Indians who have a different sense of history than we have, who have different attitudes than we have, and so on, are still bitterly opposed to many of our values and many of our ideas. And many of them are bitterly opposed to all of the bicentennial observations, particularly the research ones, which they consider to have nothing to do with human affairs and to be all mixed up with the kind of magical thinking about history that belongs to Westerners. Now these people are well aware of a long history of conflict over land, over real estate, both on the field of battle, through the courts of law, and through politics. And in recent years, this whole business of Indian land problems, which has been continuously before the courts and continuously involved in politics since the beginning of this republic, has come to be, I believe, the most fully explored and known body of law that pertains to any aspect of our legal life. I do not believe that any other body of law pertaining to any other aspect of American life has been studied so thoroughly and explored so fully and codified so fully as this. Now some of the Indians tell me this is very interesting because we think we know what this says, but we don't know what the rest of the body of American law says when it comes right down to it. The Kinzo Dam conflict started about 1924, when the attempts of the Army Corps of Engineers to build a dam at Kazua in the upper Allegheny, which would drown the corn planter Grant and would drown the largest part of Allegheny Reservation. Now, corn planter Grant was a most interesting piece of property because it had been given to the Seneca by the governor and the legislature of the state of Pennsylvania in gratitude for their aid in pacifying the western frontier as emissaries and peacemakers. And because of the problem of land loss, the legislature of Pennsylvania in the 1790s had passed a series of acts to make this corn planter grant totally inalienable. The Indians were given a title in fee simple, with the provisions that this land was not taxable, was not subject to rights of eminent domain, could not be seized for debts or seized in any court of law, and that the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania would assume the costs of a highway system and a school system within this tract. Allegheny Reservation, adjoining it in New York, was part of the original domain of the Seneca, which had never been transferred to any Western or white agent in any manner whatsoever. It was the only part left of the original land titles to any part of the Eastern United States that had never been transferred or in any other way be clouded in its title. The legal battles and series of injunctions over the construction of this dam ran for many years right up into the Kennedy administration. The Army Corps of Engineers' intention was to build the dam below these two pieces of Indian held land and flood the Indian land without ever setting a foot on it, thus avoiding any exercise of trespass law on the parts of the Indians. The construction of the dam was blocked by many, many injunctions until finally a higher court overturned one of the injunctions and the Supreme Court refused to hear the case on some basis of jurisdiction. And so at this point, the legal barriers to the construction of the dam were removed, and the Army Corps of Engineers' procedure was to go ahead and build the dam and let the Indians sue. And since they would never set a foot on Indian property, there was no way that any other body of law except this process of injunction could have been used. The case was finally carried to the President of the United States, who refused to rule on it, except that he verbally, at least, issued what amounts to an executive order. And he said, the dam shall be built, it is for the greater good. Now this and all of the other, and the dam was built. This and all of the other legal disputes of this sort led to more intensive research by many lawyers on this body of law that pertained to Indian land use than any other portion of our legal structure. And the lawyers who worked on this and who compiled these briefs and became the authorities on this all agree on the essential situation, even though some of them were employed by the Seneca, some of them were employed by the Army Corps of Engineers, and some of them were employed by other agents. They say that in terms of American law and all its precedents and its history, there is no question but that the highest law of the land is executive order by the presidency, and that there is no appeal and no control upon this. They say also that the body of the law is clear through all of its precedents in history that the Indian nations are not sovereign nations, and that the only basis for land titles in the United States is that of royal grants from the proper crown heads of Europe. And they say, besides this, in this area of the law, it is obvious that the President of the United States carries all of the total power that was ever invested in any of the kings of Europe from which came our land grants. The kings of Sweden, England, France, Spain, and the rulers of the Netherlands. And now, my Indian friends say to me, since this is now known, and since papers have been published explaining this position, what do you know about the rest of your law? How do you know that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights have any more validity than a treaty with us, when it has been demonstrated that no treaty ever made with us was ever anything but a pious act on the part of an agent of a king? And they say, with all of your concern about freedom and our concern about freedom, we think that your legal scholars ought to try to find out whether the same utter, absolute, final authority is not rested in the president for every aspect of your legal existence. And I have no idea whether this is true or not. But I and my American Indian friends find it a chilling idea. And the Indians always say, watch Indian affairs, because Indians are always a straw in the wind of politics. They say, us today, you tomorrow.